Once more under the bridge, dear friend. We had a big lag right there. Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Yeah, let's close the wall up with our English dead. Man, it's hard to talk when your own voice is
welcome back
behind.
To the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this February 23rd, 2019. That's really weird, because what was what I said when I said once more under the breach, dear friend? I get once more under the boy.
It's like, yeah, there's an app for a lot of phones out there, Samsung, the Android phones and the Apple phones. It's called Speech Jammer, and you have to be wearing the headset, but when you talk, it plays your own voice with a slight delay back into your ears, and it causes people to be completely unable to speak. They just can't say words. It's quite interesting. It's worth checking out.
If you could have that for when you get spam calls.
Yeah, just put it on for them and say, what do you think about that? And have them talk, except that most of the spam calls are recordings these days.
Well, but if you respond to the recording, you get a person mostly.
Oh, this is a cool little piece of information for you. Call centers are having trouble hiring people. This is part of the reason why you're getting recordings on your spam calls.
What's the name? Aaliyah? There is, I can't remember the name of it, but there is a robot now that they're being hired by. That's being hired by call centers. I say robot.
Yeah, but it's just voice stuff.
Not just voice. If you're doing it, if you have a visual screen where you can see the person you're talking to, you see a person with the appropriate, a beautiful young lady with long blonde hair who will talk to you. And apparently does a better job than the typical person, the typical hire. And several companies have basically fired all of their call center people and are using this program strictly to one by one. They're doing this now. If there's a highly
have to hire, the manager has to have an Austrian accent. He's got a, and they call him the Terminator. Case. So he's walking around in the back, making sure that they're treating customers correctly.
Well, the point is that this thing, if it gets over its head, if you ask a question or something and says, "Just a moment, let me put you in touch with somebody who can help you," but about 80 to 90, and again, I don't remember the name of the program or the company, and I'm sorry about that. I just remember reading the article this week. But the idea is, their actual referral rate from the robot, which I say robot, this beautiful young lady with a very personable voice, a very personable appearance, who could easily pass the Turing test.
Turing tests are not that hard to pass anymore.
The point is that the referral rate to the more knowledgeable people is about half of what they had when they had live well-trained people on the phone desk. And secondly, when they survey the people who call in and or who get called, they find that they're far more satisfied with this robot than they were with the people when human beings were hired. Which brings us into a whole different subject area that I wanted to, and I think you do want to talk about.
What's that?
The ongoing impact of automation. It is It is much more profound than self-driving cars. And we talked about the first hour. I don't remember whether we talked about it in the car or anyway. There's a company in the United States that was making machine parts overseas.
Yeah, no, we talked about it in the car.
And they have decided to stop making machine parts in China, and they're going to make them strictly in the United States now. Which you say, yay, jobs coming back to the United States?
No jobs.
Well,
machines.
Maybe a few. But the point is, they have concluded that the key to their machine, their specialty machine part, and it's custom machine parts. You want a special part for a machine that's no longer made by the manufacturer, they will machine it for you and get it to you very quickly. And the way they do that is they have automated systems that if you give the specifications to it, it cuts it out of metal and ships it. And the point is, they could get this done in China probably cheaper.
But the shipping and the delay of getting it over here compound the issue.
When you get a broken part in a machine and a company is trying to make something, trying to manufacture stuff, and their machine goes down, having somebody they can contact that will get them a quality part quickly is a crucial issue. So they're basically shutting down their low-cost overseas production over the next several years and going to go strictly to what we would call inaccurately artificial intelligence in the United States to do it.
Right, which is the market solution. We want our goods faster. When we're ordering something, we want it as soon as we can get it. And we have the technology to do that. It's been expensive. So we've settled for, hey, I need a part. I'll wait a couple of months to get it here, or I'll spend a lot of extra money to get it here faster. If you look at the price of air shipment from China on a custom-made part, you'll find that it's less expensive to have it manufactured in the United States and sent at a much lower rate, shipping rate, to you. And if you want to wait the 2 months, you can still do it from China. But the thing with automation is it's getting cheaper. It's the automation is building the next layer of automation so that it's going to be less expensive. The machines that are put together to automate something are generally the first layer are made by humans.
And the article I read in Financial Times was talking about a study that suggested that countries around the world, for instance in Africa, that have lots of low-cost labor but haven't capitalized on that by setting up factories to make things for the developed world, have a very quickly closing window to do so, or they're going to miss out completely. And again, the reason is, it's kind of like, the reason is can be seen in the VCR player.
Yeah. What is a VCR? For those folks that were born in the 90s.
It's a video cassette recorder.
Yes, it is a tape that you had to rewind when you were done watching a movie.
And the point is,
if you paused it, it would cause the scene to stretch and weird shapes to happen. If you watched it again, you could tell where it was paused.
And this VCR players are same thing as today a CD player and then a DVD player and a Blu-ray player. We've gone past those now,
too.
Now we're just virtual. Streaming.
Yeah, streaming.
But the point is that there was a lot of complaint back in the last century and millennium that we had invented the VCR player in the United States, and none of them were made in the United States. They were all being made in China and Japan and Southeast Asia and shipped to the United States, and how terrible that was. And then all of a sudden they weren't being made at all because they were passed right on by. The issue of foreign labor taking jobs from Americans, every study that I've read in the past several years has said the same thing. No. If there's any jobs being taken by foreign labor, they're precious few, and you couldn't fill them with people in the United States anyway. The thing that's taking jobs is automation, and automation is going to take a lot more jobs, and coming out of the next recession, we're probably going to see a tsunami of job disappearance, and it'll have nothing to do with stuff moving overseas. It'll have to do with the fact that automation is growing exponentially in its effectiveness. And it's getting better and better and cheaper to make things with machines.
There's an easy example here. Where the cost of labor is only the beginning factor. The example I'm going to give first isn't the easy one. It's fracking. And this is kind of a medium example. Fracking required the cost of a barrel of oil to be above about $70 a barrel for an extremely prolonged period of time, at least 3 years.
Extremely prolonged
well,
is 3 years?
For when you're talking about wildcatters that are looking at, you know, week to week,
yeah,
that is a
you.
Long period of time. So fracking technology was developed because we maintained the price of oil above that $70 a barrel point for a long time. Well, it doesn't need to be above $70 a barrel anymore for it to remain profitable to do fracking. The initial technology was a lot more expensive than what's come later. It's gotten cheaper and will continue to be cheaper over time to do what that initial investment was. And when we're talking about labor costs, it costs a lot of money to replace a bunch of farm labor with a completely unknown technology that you're testing as you go along, and it breaks, and you got to keep fixing it and figure out how to get it to work. But once you've got a good design, you're doing little incremental improvements on it. It gets a lot less expensive and a lot more stable. The price of labor could drop to extremely low amounts, and it would still be cheaper to do it in an automated fashion, because right now it's more expensive to keep the labor on. If you've got to keep paying high prices for farm labor, you're going to have money thrown at automation. If you're going to, and this is the easy example, what happened across many of the Western states over the last several years is the minimum wages in municipalities and states have gone way up, which has caused many fast food type restaurants to lay off employees, to make them go part-time. And now this kiosk concept is out there where McDonald's will allow you to come. Have you used the kiosk?
I have.
And have you used the kiosk in Texas?
Yes.
But the minimum wage in Texas didn't go up. The minimum wage in Texas is still $7.25. So the fact that in California and in Washington state, they raised the minimum wage enough to make the investment in those kiosk technologies cost effective, meant that they can lay off people in Texas where their wages didn't go up because the technology became inexpensive enough. Now, that hasn't had a lasting effect on the job market. In fact, the people that have been laid off or not hired when someone leaves at McDonald's have gone on to work at other places. So it's not like we have this big spike in unemployment because McDonald's made this move. But when you do this across the board, which is we have set politically and economically the environment to give the most innovative support to automation. When you have a trade war that makes a long, complicated supply chain that was cheap before, expensive, it's worth spending the money to figure out how to manufacture with a machine on site. And that's where we are. A lot of money is being spent on automation. Tesla says that Elon Musk, which, you know, he makes some promises that aren't exactly timely if you consider 6 months as too large a window. He says that by the end of 2020, a Tesla should be able to drive with the driver asleep. So if you just look at his track record, he's been off by about 6 months. So we're talking about a year and a half before cars can drive while you sleep. Even if he's 2 years off, then we're talking about 3 years, and it will be standard for cars to be more in charge than the humans, and that will cause...
I would conservatively say 2025.
That's very conservative, yeah.
Would be, and things tend to take a little longer. Not with Tesla, but I'm just saying, because Tesla certainly don't dominate the highway, because their battery life is still a problem. But I would say that around 2025... you're going to see the tipping point where self-driving cars begin to dominate traffic. And self-driving cars is the very visible issue. But the fact is the impact on the United States is going to be pretty strong, because a lot of menial manual labor jobs are going to be done by machines that are now done by people, low-skilled jobs, repetitious jobs, mind-boring jobs are probably in trouble, and some of the cognitive jobs are going to be in trouble because there's things that machines can learn now that they couldn't learn before, and there's even more coming. But that won't be the big one. That won't be the big effect, in my opinion. The big effect will be in the rest of the world. The developing world, if you will, is largely dependent on making things to ship to the developed world. And China's, for example, China has this huge export imbalance where they bring in a lot of raw material, they make a lot of stuff with cheap labor, and then they ship it out. But their wages in China are gradually inching up. The cost of doing business in China is gradually inching up. And the cost of automation is on the way down. And think about what happens if your export-driven society, where the stability of your society depends on exporting a lot of stuff to the United States, and the United States has a revolution in automation and starts making all that stuff themselves.
All right, and this is just a little side note on what you had said about the battery life.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla, just this month, bought a U.S. battery maker, Maxwell Technologies.
Right.
They make supercapacitors and a new kind of battery. The new kind of battery is about double the energy density, and regular capacitors, or it's not supercapacitors, it's ultra capacitor. Yeah, I'm sorry, I used the wrong word. Ultra, I thought of as a...
You could say super ultra.
Super ultra. Ultra capacitors can store between 10 and 100 times more energy than regular capacitors. What does that mean? Capacitors generally have to be topped off by the battery, and it costs some energy to keep topping them off. The more you can fill them at one point and keep them full, the more efficient the process is. So battery technology, this is certainly not a plug for Tesla. Tesla is just spending a lot of money in this area. Amazon is starting an electric pickup truck company with $700 million. So Ford and General Motors and many others are investing money in batteries and in driving your car without you. This is not pie in the sky anymore. It will be 3 to 5 years from now, we're going to say, well, of course this is the way it is. This is how serious I am about it. I'm not going to buy another car until it's able to drive itself. Because otherwise, this is just for you, little piece of information out there. If you have a car that cannot drive itself in the future, it's going to be worth a lot less than cars that do.
Mm-hmm.
The demand will drop. It's a lot safer. It's kind of like saying, would you like to buy my car that doesn't have a seatbelt or an airbag or air conditioning or power windows? And you'd say, is this an antique? I'll buy it for the antique purpose. If it's not, then why am I buying it?
And at some point in the 2020s, I'll make a tongue-in-cheek forecast, because I certainly can't tell you what the future is going to do. I would say there's a high probability that you're going to see entire highways some point in the 2020s that you cannot self-drive a car on. You have to go back roads to get someplace.
Yeah, you cannot get on, at least in lanes where you will only be allowed to drive if it's driverless.
But eventually, you know,
be just everywhere.
Eventually it's kind of like airplane flight. We weren't at all sensitive to the fact that people got killed when airplanes crashed until we suddenly tipped at a certain point and became hypersensitive to airplanes crashing and people dying. And now airplanes just don't crash anymore and people don't die anymore because they're becoming more and more automated. At some point, we'll get used to the fact that it's safe to drive, and some manual driver, probably drunk, will do something and kill a lot of people in their safe self-driving cars. And then the laws are going to start to come out.
Yeah.
And we're going to say it's not safe to have people driving cars who can be distracted. Who get on their telephone. But we don't have an alternative at this point.
No, we killed 37,500 people on the roads in 2017. If there were any other mechanical death rate that high, I mean, this is the number one mm-hmm. cause of death
right.
in children in the United States. By far, you put all the other diseases together, and you don't reach the cause of death in automobile accidents. This is one of the good things that will happen, is that we're not going to be killing that number of people. And it wasn't a huge amount of time ago that we were killing people in the 40,000 range. The death rate has come down with airbags and seatbelts and crumple zones and all the other cool technologies, and those aren't going to go away. We're just going to have cars that are a lot more reactive, much faster in solving problems and getting us out of the way of danger. And then eventually, traffic jams disappear because computers can handle them a lot better than humans can.
Yeah, and it's coming. And like I said, the impact in driving trucks and cars is pretty obvious.
Now,
it's not obvious in some of the secondary and tertiary and quaternary and quinternary. And
right.
then it actually goes to sexenary, which we don't want to get into.
Now, to calm the fears, because there's a lot of fears out there. We've just been talking about the good stuff. There's going to be a lot of job loss out of this. To calm that, the way historically people have succeeded through this type of innovation, whether that's the Industrial Revolution or any of the other major technological shifts that we've had throughout history, is by owning the thing that's being revolutionized. If you own the companies that own the robots, then you benefit.
Or you own the companies that benefit from the robots.
Right. So ownership is not in doubt at this point. Incomes, that's in doubt. If you're talking about whether or not you have a job next week because a robot comes and takes your place, if you own a chunk of the company and you've been putting away money for that purpose, it gives you a little bit more incentive to look ahead. This is the sort of thing, this is not maybe it will happen. It's an extremely high probability. It would take a major, major social economic collapse for us not to get this. And that may even just speed it up.
We're already seeing automobile sales sagging earlier than economic history would suggest that they would sag. And that is, and surveys have gone around and said, why is this happening? We already had people in cities, larger cities, where traffic is a problem and where parking is a problem, not buying cars at the same rate as they used to. Now, with Uber and Lyft kind of ubiquitous across cities, there are fewer people buying cars. And I can tell you that the forecast, and I think they're accurate, is that once we get into the point where you have automated cars that are reliable and show up very quickly, so that if you decide you want to go someplace, you pop it into your phone or whatever, your watch or whatever, and the car shows up and you tell it where to go and it takes you there and you get out and you don't have to worry about parking, you don't have to worry about traffic, you don't have to worry about having a place to park near your house, the sales of automobiles will effectively plummet and eventually
in major cities.
In major cities. Now, the
if
question,
you're living out in the country, you're still going to need more dedicated vehicles.
Maybe, but eventually, it's kind of like rural electrification. Eventually, it will come out into the rural areas. And the last area probably to be filled up would be things like people who drive pickups because they want to haul stuff around in them and beat up their pickups. Obviously, you don't want to beat up somebody else's pickup. But I think we're going to see this. And as I said, the big issues are going to be, and you stop and think about it, well, obviously there are going to be fewer accidents, which means there'll be fewer people working in body shops. An entire category of labor in highly skilled labor suddenly disappears if you don't need internal combustion mechanics. You know, the new Green Deal says that by 2030 or something, that's way too quick. But I would say by 2050, you're going to see very few internal combustion engines on the highway.
I think the thing that will work here, and this goes back to a pretty fundamental economic principle, government restrictions may slow something down or speed something up, but the transition takes place when a new technology mm-hmm. comes along. So coal is an example. We have a very coal-friendly administration right now. That's putting it lightly. We have extremely good circumstances at the governmental level for coal energy. But more coal plants have shut down under the Trump administration than under the Obama administration
right.
in all 8 years. And it has nothing to do with the governmental influence. It has to do with natural gas is cheaper. It also happens happily to be cleaner, but that's not why coal disappeared. It wasn't because there's a cleaner technology. It's because there's a cheaper technology that was also cleaner. And that's what we're talking about. Internal combustion engine, you got to have a cheaper technology that also happens to be cleaner.
And you think about coal for just a second and you think about, okay, well, that means coal plants shut down and coal mines shut down. But you don't realize it's a huge effect on the railroads at the same time.
Right,
what I'm trying to say is there's so many ramifications to all of these things.
Much of the railroads, the capacity on the railroads were filled with massive amounts of coal being shipped from one part of the country to the other to power stations to make power for your houses, and now that's not there. Now we're shipping enough other stuff that we filled up the railroad quickly enough anyway.
There's a couple of unusual numbers floating around too. This is no segue. This is a different area.
We're switching the subject
into something more immediate.
Please hold your whiplash collar closely.
We got the U.S. existing home sales in for January, and they dropped 1.2%. Factory output in January, we now have from the labor, and we're starting to pick up this information, it contracted 0.6%. And while unemployment claims fell for the month, the four-week moving – or for the week that we just closed, the four-week moving average of claims rose to the highest since January of last year. And here's the other kicker that you need to pay attention to. The leading economic indicators declined 0.1%. Now, that's no big thing. It has to decline for about 3 months before it triggers a warning. But what's happened is in about half the months, beginning in the fourth quarter, in about half the months, the leading economic indicators declined or rose. So it's bobbing back and forth. And the six-month growth in the leading economic indicators is now merely up 0.8%. Now, what does that mean in the big picture for you and me and in the immediate future? And it really boils down to something fairly simple. We're in a plateau. The United States economy is barely growing. I suspect when the GDP for the fourth quarter finally gets released, it's going to be around 1.5 to 1.7, with warning that the first quarter of this year is looking slower than that.
Yeah, we've got some major snowstorms that are still hitting. The West Coast all the way through Arizona has been dumped on with snow, and the Northeast has had two major snowstorms.
Well, now, the Commerce Department has adjusted its first quarter GDP reading, seasonally adjusted, to account for the fact that we've had unusual blizzards that are becoming usual. But the point is, you might want to brace yourself for the fact that the United States economy is slowing. Now, the question going forward, and we bring this up in the newsletter, and it's important to realize, if the tariffs get enacted as threatened, the 25% against European autos, 25% against Chinese imports, the continuing 10%, is it 10% against Canadian steel?
It's 25 on steel, 10% on aluminum.
In other words, these high tariffs stay in place and continue to go up. We will probably tip into recession this year. If the tariffs, the threatened tariffs, don't get enacted, but the old tariffs, the ones that we're talking about, this tariff on steel, for example, remains in place, we're still going to teeter on the edge, and something little could throw us into a recession. If you remove all the tariffs, we probably have serious growth into 2020, at least, and we have probably a delightful stock market surge going up. The stock market is continuing to be optimistic that the Chinese tariffs won't hit. The bond market, not so much. And it's going to be a really fascinating circus to watch. And for the first time in my memory, and my memory goes back through about four decades of observing the economy now, for the first time in my memory, the President of the United States really does have the power to make a difference in the economy. Unfortunately, his power is mostly negative at this point. And it's going to be
if we have good trade deals out of it, then we can say sure, this is a positive. But we're not seeing the trade deals yet. I mean, it's the preliminary stuff.
Very frankly, even if we see great trade deals out of it, the uncertainty about the supply chain is already disrupting and slowing things down in the United States economy as people begin to realize that it could happen again. We could suddenly see a switch. Just like we suddenly see a switch, we have an agreement with China, and we're going to lower tariffs, and everything's going to be happy again, but something could happen, and they could go back into place, so people no longer have faith in the supply chain. Ultimately, I think this is going to be good, because we'll move to automation, but in the intermediate, it's going to be a bumpy road. Be aware of the fact that this is a necessary part of growth that we're going through. And not to panic when you see bad things happen and the United States tip into recession or the stock market takes a nosedive. A lot of people got shook up last quarter.
I think it's got shaken up, unless you're singing a 1960s song.
I'm all shook up?
Yeah.
But that's correct. I mean, obviously.
I'm all shook up.
I mean, if Elvis said it, if the King said it, it must be correct. But anyway, a lot of people were shaken up.
I think using the correct vocabulary and grammar in songs would, I mean, just think how good this song would sell. Ow! I feel well.
I think it'd be really good.
It would be pretty, well, you just said good.
I think it would be good.
Oh, so it's an ethical thing. Okay. All right. So anyway, I'm sorry. That was a horrible interruption.
Did you know that in the Beatles, Paul McCartney's father said they should
McCartney?
Say McCartney. Paul McCartney's father told them instead of yeah, 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 they should say yes, yes, yes.
Mm.
Because yeah was an Americanism.
Yeah, I'm sure that wouldn't have gone over as well. Although with their voices, it might have.
You never can tell. Anyway.
The economy was shaken up.
That's... What I'm trying to say is the bond market, and a lot of economists said one way or another, we're going to get an economic downturn. We're going to get a recession. It's a matter of when and how severe. Economic recessions normally are accompanied by bear markets. It's a matter of when and how severe. And three, don't worry about it. Have your dry powder ready, but don't try to time the market. And we need to do commercials.
Yeah, we do. We're going to play some commercials. We'll be back. We'll talk about hacking of blockchain.
We'll
talk about cryptocurrencies. We'll talk about the Labor Department and the effect it's had on the rollover of IRAs from 401ks, the Labor Department's fiduciary rule being killed. So we will be back on the other side with a lot of more stuff to talk about on the other end. And if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. The phone number in here is
254-773-1400.
Thanks, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400.
Yes. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is JB.
Hello, JB.
Living the dream, saving money, buy more Bibles, more guns. big question. I work for an employer, a great employer. We have a traditional pension plan where they fund 8 to 15% of our salary a year. We have a 401k that we contribute to that they don't match. And then they also offer us the opportunity to contribute to a Roth IRA. And I take advantage of everything except the Roth. I haven't done that yet. And I was just wondering, if I do start contributing to that, is that eligible for the Roth IRA tax break? And I was wondering, since there's no employer matching my 401k, if I'm letting some tax breaks go on that I should be able to get.
All right. I'm going to kind of approach that from a couple
of
different directions.
From the side.
Yeah. When you say there's a Roth, you said Roth IRA. Is it a Roth component of the 401k?
See, I'm not sure. I think it might be.
Okay. A lot of times the 401ks now allow you to put money into the Roth side of it. So the question about whether you should use it or not, whether or not you're getting the tax advantages, first, you need to talk to your tax preparer about this as well to get the specifics, because we're going to cover some generalities. The generality is, if you look at your taxes and you think in retirement you're going to be paying more taxes than you are today, your income's going to be higher, or you think the taxes are going to come up. Do you think that? Do you think that you're going to have more money coming in retirement, or taxes are going to be higher than they are today in retirement?
Well, that's about 18 years out, but, you know, depending on my health, I may be making more money in retirement.
Okay.
I have another business on the side, too, and I would be able to draw my retirement from my employer, plus I'd be able to put more time into my business.
That tells you a world right there.
Yeah. You have just about answered all the questions we need to figure this out. If you think that you are in a lower tax bracket today than you will be when you're taking money out of your retirement accounts, then you should probably be using a Roth. Means you'll pay the taxes today, but it goes into the Roth, and the Roth then isn't taxed all the way out there. After you pull money out after 59 and a half, you can pull that money out without ever having to pay taxes on it. There are some restrictions. You got to look into this carefully. Don't just take my word for it. Get talking with the tax preparers and so on.
You know, one of the things you want to be aware that if you go to the Roth, let's just say, I'm just going to make a wild guess here, and I'm going to use 20%. Let's just say you make $1,000 and you pay 20% in taxes, and I don't know that you pay that much on the last $1,000 you make. then you only have $800 left to put in the Roth IRA. If you make $1,000 and you have a 20%, your highest tax bracket is 20%, then you're in the position of you make $1,000, you put $1,000 into the IRA, and you don't pay that 20%. To be ready for that shock, if you use a Roth IRA, that you can only put away $800 a month worth versus $1,000. And in exchange, though, if you think your taxes are going to be higher when you take the money out of your IRA than they are today,
say 25%,
then you're probably better off doing the Roth. And it's a hard guess. It's a hard decision to make. And you get a lot of quick, pleasurable, no tax paid today on the regular IRA. The important thing is not the Roth or regular. That's not the important thing. The important thing is do one or the other, and you're already doing that. In other words, do something. Do something in the way of tax deferral.
Now, because they're not matching you, you're not losing any tax advantage from that. You are losing free money. If you had a 401k that gave you money when you put money in, that's free money. And even if somebody says, I've got a really horrible 401k, I still want them to get as much matching as they can get. I mean, really horrible means that it's mediocre. It doesn't mean it's really bad. 401ks have some regulations that say they have to meet certain criteria, so they can't be really bad, although I suppose that could exist. The idea here is if you can have matching, utilize it. If you can't, then it's a question of could you get as much money as you're putting into the 401k into an IRA or a Roth IRA and have better choices on what's going on. If you don't have the time or the resources to do the research on how to invest there, then using the 401k works really well. And again, if the kind of reiterating that first part, if you think you're going to be paying a higher amount in taxes as a percentage later on when you're pulling this money out, then a Roth is a better example, but is a better method. But if you're at the peak of your earning potential, you're making lots and lots of money right now, you should be maxing out your 401k's tax deductions so that later on when you're not at the peak of your earning potential, if you're making less money in retirement, then you're taking it out at a lower tax than what you saved by putting it away now.
I guess but one thing I want to clarify now, since there's no employer match on this plan, we have a separate pension plan too that, like I say, it's a really good deal. Not many companies have that anymore.
Right.
Can I claim the IRA deduction on my taxes, I wonder? Of course, y'all are tax professionals, but, I mean, since I'm the only one contributing to the plan, I would think because I've gotten in trouble with that stuff in the past. I'm trying
The documents that's given to you at the end of the year by your employer will show how much went into the 401k. So you don't take an IRA deduction on that. It's already deducted. And when you put this into your taxes, you just put it in from the right box to the right box, and it will say you got the deduction.
But you can't do an IRA in addition unless you're in a – well, you can do one. You just probably won't get the – if you have a reasonable income, you probably will not get the tax deduction. You'll do a non-deductible IRA, which I would recommend against, because it becomes an accounting nightmare on the back end.
Unless you're immediately doing a backdoor conversion to a Roth IRA. But now we're talking about some really complicated things.
Yeah, and there's a lot of complexities you can get into, but unless you're in a relatively high tax bracket and you're willing to pay your CPA some serious money, you probably ought to stay away from that stuff.
Yeah, I probably already messed all that up then. But, I mean, I still paid quite a bit. I paid, about $12,000 last year to them.
Into the 401k?
Not to the IRS.
No, to the IRS.
Oh. Well, thank you, sir.
We
thank you, sir.
We thank you very much for assisting us in controlling the deficit.
Yeah.
I failed to get my Trump tax cut.
You did provide at least, like, the paint for 5 or 6 miles of the I-35 highway, and I appreciate that very much. I like to know where the lanes end.
You know, I'd like to hear from people like you. I'm really fascinated by this because I've talked to clients we have who work regularly in regular jobs where they get paid just like you do. And I've asked them to look at their 2017 and 2018 dollar taxes they paid and see if they actually got a tax cut. And I've had 3 of them report back to me right now, and they said, nope, we didn't get a tax cut, but we sure got a lower tax refund coming. We got it in effect, and I don't know how this is working out. I'm not any genius that I can understand the tax law, but I can say that so far three people have reported to me that the Trump tax cut was a tax increase for them.
Right, and that's very reasonable. This is an important little piece here. We're very directly connected to this. If you buy a mutual fund and you pay a commission, that commission's not taxed. But if you take the advice of somebody who's working in your best interest to buy the same mutual fund, but at a much lower price, and you pay a fee to that person that gave you good advice, and generally the fee is a lot less than that front-end commission, that fee is not tax deductible. So it used to be, and it wasn't intentionally made to make an uneven playing field, but we find that a little bit
irritating.
Because, you know, there's a big push for people to get people that they trust that are giving them fiduciary advice in their best interest. And then you take away a tax incentive to do it.
Yeah, but
that's a little weird.
That's our axe to grind.
It is our axe to grind. We're prejudiced on this.
I'm honestly curious, anyone wants to tell me whether they paid more or less taxes in 2017 or 2018.
I can tell you who's paid less taxes. And this is the for sure. Is corporations.
When I'm talking about individuals.
Okay. The corporate tax cut is real. The individual tax cut is kind of a toss-up. A lot of people got a tax cut. A lot of people didn't. A lot of people got a tax increase.
Well, in my profession, what I do for my regular job, I kind of took away my ability to itemize because a lot of things that we would itemize in the past, now they did increase the standard deduction.
Yeah, that's right. What I was curious
right.
about.
To kind of... I think it, making up words, de-incentivize you on to itemize, but, you know, but a lot of the things that we would...
I'm just
claim,
curious. I'm
we
just...
can't claim anymore, so I actually paid more.
You
yeah.
did. And
you
I'm,
paid more.
This is what I'm... This is what I've been seeing. I don't care what the theory is. What I'm seeing is the middle class that we have encountered so far did not get a tax cut. The corporations did, but you didn't. There was actually a tax increase on the middle class and a tax cut on corporations, and I think maybe there was a little false advertising in that tax bill.
Or enough lack of research. And we're about out of time. We got to cover some other stuff. Thank you very much for the call. Really appreciate it. All right.
I'm just curious. It's kind of like I'd like to see the final result, not the theory that.
Yeah. If you look at the effective tax rate at the end, when you're done, either if you're doing TurboTax or you're tax preparer, you're going to have an effective tax rate. That has nothing to do with tax brackets. It will say how much of your income did you send on to the U.S. Treasury Department. If that percentage went up, then you didn't get a tax cut. You got a tax increase.
And you know, it's one of those things where I'd like to hold Congress, and I'm not saying one party or the other, accountable. You know, for example, when Obamacare passed, I was asking people, did your cost of health insurance go down or up, or did it stay the same?
And what we got was the first year it went down, and the second year it went down, and the third year it went up, and it's been up every year since then. So what do we have out of that? It was not the panacea that was promised by the Democrats. And when you have the same situation on the tax cut, we're going to hold the Republicans to the same standard that we held the Democrats. If you say this is a tax cut and we're looking around and a lot of people had a tax increase, then we're labeling it the wrong thing. Let's say something very clear. The tax cut for the corporations was vitally needed. We had the highest corporate tax rate in the world. We needed to cut that. It was stifling growth. But we've then replaced it with tariffs, which is a different form of taxation. It's a taxation on the consumer.
Well, it's taxation on the consumer, except that so far the companies paying tariffs have largely not passed it on to consumers, which means it's basically...
They're eating it up. Yeah, they're not raising the prices.
They got their taxes cut, and then they got a tax increase.
Yeah. So that's part of the uncertainty we talked about in the first hour, is that we had a lot of certainty of lower taxes. But then we had kind of a backdoor raise of taxes in any kind of international trade. And it's affected a lot of the non-international trade because a lot of the other goods, their prices have been affected by the prices of imports and exports. So that's where we are. We're trying to gather this up and have a picture that is not made of political slogans, but what is the real effect on the bottom line? Just like Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, just we're going to look at the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and say, what was the result?
One of the things I think you need to look at, and you can look at this in your 401k, Franklin Templeton just paid a $14 million fine.
Yeah, I saw that.
For the 401k they were offering their employees, and this is just one of many that have popped up recently. And this is true if you're using mutual funds. It's a fairly easy thing to do. If you're using mutual funds either in your 401k or from a, quote, financial advisor, end quote, go to Morningstar, Morningstar.com, and it's a free service unless you want the detailed stuff. You can pay. I recommend people get it just if they're using mutual funds, just to read the analysis. But you can go to the purchase tab for Morningstar for your mutual fund, and it'll show you the different share classes and what they cost inside each share class. And if you go down through there, you may find that there is a share class you may be paying the highest internal fee available for the share class that you have, in which case you're losing some serious money each year. And you also want to look at that in your 401k. And if your 401k, theoretically, under the law, your 401k should be using the lowest price share class available. But in fact,
in many cases, especially if you have a safe harbor position, it's not in there.
The Labor Department, in many cases, well, the Labor Department doesn't have its own police force. Therefore, unless somebody complains,
they don't even know about it.
They don't know that the law is being broken. And what happens is, in a lot of cases, the higher price share class is paying a salesman who buys stuff and gives gifts to the executives who make the decision as to what share class, so that you wind up paying a lot more money in your 401k with your money than is appropriate. And it's one of those things just to be aware of, whether you're in a 401k or an IRA or whatever you're in, go. Morningstar's got it right there, and it's free. You go to Morningstar.com, and you type in the name of your mutual fund, or if you know the symbol, it works even better, and then go to the Purchase tab, and it'll show you all the different share classes. And in most cases, it'll show you the actual fee, but if not, you can go to each of the different symbols and see what the internal cost is. And I think it's very important to realize that a broker has no obligation to give you the cheapest, the least expensive share class. As a matter of fact, they're kind of incentivized to get you the highest price share class. And it will, particularly in this environment where we're getting relatively low growth last couple of years. The market was basically flat to down. We're still down below where the peak was last year. That hurts. That sucks your returns down pretty significantly. And I think it's important to have a discussion with whoever is advising you or whoever is running the show about the costs.
I want to say a quick acknowledgement to wish peace toward Eugenia. She's gone home, and that's an important thing. Just take a moment to... Most of you don't know who that is, but she was a very wonderful person. So I want to take a moment to say that. And now we're about out of time for this episode of The Personal Wealth Coach.
Are we episodic?
We are, episodically.
Well, if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have a local telephone number. We have voicemail on the weekend, live people answering the phone. We don't have a phone tree during business hours. And that is 254-947-1111. Or
you're toll free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. There's newsletters there. There's just recordings of the radio program going back lots of years. That's the webpage is tpwc.com or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can email us directly, Jeff at tpwc.com.